Good morning. Up right now on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville, it's the Mind and Heart Show. For the next hour, it's thoughts and feelings and the way they affect our lives and the world we live in. The phone number in the studio is 434-284-9470. Now here's your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier.
And good morning, Charlottesville, and welcome to the Mind and Heart Show. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, your host, and I want to welcome you to the show. We're on 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are here every Saturday morning live from 9 until 10. And our show deals with all matters of the mind and heart, including mental health, stress, life transitions, parenting, sexuality, spirituality, and on and on. So please join us this morning by visiting our Facebook page, The Mind and Heart Show, or send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC, or you can email us at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. You can also listen to the show the Monday following on SeavillePodcast.com. You can go to Seaville Podcast, just put Mind and Heart in the search box, and the shows for our current and past shows will come up. Kevin Chapman's with us here this morning as producer, and we want to welcome and thank him for coming. I'm very pleased this morning to have as my guest Mary Flo Stevens, who is a multi-talented person who I've come to know recently. She's an author, a teacher, a critic, and really is someone I consider one of the most informed persons in our community with regards to literature, writing, and the like. So welcome, Mary Flo. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Could we start with just a little bit of background? I want our listeners to get a sense of just how you sort of have, what the trajectory that you followed in terms of your career and right up to the current time.
Sure. I was a journalist before I turned to fiction writing, and the world of journalism changed greatly in the 10 years I was in it, which was 1973 onward to 1982. And then I still freelanced for the Washington Post in particular for my whole career. But I always wanted to write fiction. And I was working at the Bergen Record in Hackensack, New Jersey, writing headlines and doing copy editing on the midnight to 8 a.m. shift. And I came to Charlottesville on a vacation. And I was first a music major before I switched to English, which was my love. And I saw a sign in the Gaslight Restaurant for a piano bar player. And I thought, I've always wanted to do that.
Oh, that's
and
great.
I was coming to visit Fred Heblich, who was in law school at the time. And my line is, I'm still on my visit. So I, you know, emailed, I guess this was before email, called my boss and said I'll come and work the 2 weeks, but then I'm over here. I'm done with writing headlines in the middle of the night. I want to write short stories.
That's great. And certainly Charlottesville is a wonderful community, and it looks like when you got here you decided to put down stakes, and here you are.
I did.
And since then, you've taught, you've written, you've been a critic. I mean, can you give us a little bit of that background in terms of your professional life?
Well, I do have an essay I've worked on but never finished called Accidental Teacher, because I never meant to become a teacher. But I got my MFA in creative writing at UVA, and I knew that I would be able to find a job teaching writing, so I've taught at PVCC. And then I got on with the rhetoric program at Hampton Sydney College, which is persuasive writing.
Interesting.
So I taught there. But my real forte and what I really enjoy is teaching creative writing. And I taught that at Hollins University most recently. I've also taught through the BIS program.
At UVA.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Returning students.
Yeah. And you are currently working on some of your own writing. You've got some stuff in the pipeline.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I'm trying to sell a middle grade novel that's set here in Charlottesville that I started researching when my now 30-year-old daughter was studying Lewis and Clark in the, how old are you in the fourth grade? Nine?
Probably nine, yeah.
Yeah,
nine. I would say nine.
I wrote a play. She was very upset that her friends at St. Anne's were all studying drama, and she was in public school, and there was no drama. So for 2 years running, I wrote and directed a play. And the second play was the story of York, the slave, who went west with Lewis and Clark.
Right.
And it was called, the play was called Hidden Heroes of Lewis and Clark, Sacagawea and York. And so my novel for young readers is in the voice of an 11-year-old African-American boy in Charlottesville who says, "Hey, whatever happened to York?" Which is actually the title of a book, nonfiction book, Whatever Happened to York. I'm refining that novel now. It's finished, but it needs editing.
Yeah.
Everything does.
Right. Yeah, as a reader, I certainly appreciate that. Sometimes I read a book and think, this could have used a little heavier hand of editing.
Yeah, really?
It just goes on and on. Yeah. So talk for a minute, if you would, about the importance of literature in your life, the importance as a reader, the importance of,
Well, I told you in the car on the way over here, I just got back from a writing conference in New York, and I'm going to reference a talk by the founder of Greenhouse Literary Agency, Sarah Davies, because she mentioned the number of times that reading had saved her, especially as a middle schooler.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about it ever since then. There were a number of times when I was growing up that reading saved me. And I've just written down some of the books that had that effect. And one of them was Little Women.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was To Kill a Mockingbird. And sadly, Harper Lee just died.
Just died, yes.
My other favorite books are The Color Purple and a book that not everybody knows called I'm One of You Forever.
Don't know that one.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Yeah.
He's not commercial. And On the Road, which I've taught. I've developed a class called Writing About the Road. I've probably read On the Road 10
Jack
times.
Kerouac, yeah.
Yeah, Jack Kerouac. And I met Allen Ginsberg's farm manager when I was 21 because his sister married my first cousin.
Okay.
And when he explained to my mother, "Well, I work for a poet, Allen Ginsberg," my mother said, to my great embarrassment, "My daughter's a poet too." So I've always followed Allen Ginsberg and everything he writes. I also love the novel Beloved and the novel Housekeeping by Mary Lynn Robinson.
Right.
And a memoir by Paula, I think her name is Jones, called Borrowed Finery. I've read that 3 times. And as a young child, I just wanted to sit and read. And I remember so often my mother would say, "You need to get outside. You need the sunshine. You need to get some exercise." And I would think, "No, I need to read."
Yeah, it reminds me, my own coming of age and the hours and hours I spent in my room reading, and what a wonderful source of escape and solace and perspective. I just feel like it broadens our worldview, and I feel badly that kids these days seem to read a lot less with the computers and the iPhones and all that, because to me it was just formative and life-changing.
Right. Or they're not directed to read the right things.
Right.
I have one student now I'm tutoring in creative writing, and his school is great. Both my daughters graduated from Tandem Friends, and everybody should read Huckleberry Finn, and he was reading that, but he's writing science fiction and fantasy. And I said, "You know what? You need to read Neil Gaiman. You need to read The Ocean at the End of the Lane," because I knew that would click with him. And sometimes you need to have somebody kind of direct your reading.
Yeah. As a psychologist, I'm always interested in the impact of reading and fiction and nonfiction even on our sort of personal journey, and wonder if you had thoughts about that. And
I have thoughts about it, and I've actually been wanting to reference this article for years, ever since January of 2014, and here's the article from the Washington Post. The headline says, "Researchers say that reading a novel can change the biology of your brain."
Golly.
After reading a novel, actual changes linger in the brain at least for a few years. And then it quotes a neuroscientist who says, "Stories shape our lives and in some cases help define a person. we want to understand how stories get into your brain and what they do to it. And then it goes on about neurological research and things I don't understand. But basically, they say reading a novel makes you smarter. Something I've always thought.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but I certainly wouldn't disagree with it. You know, I'm also thinking about the ways in which literature, the level of insight, as a psychologist, the level of insight that I see from so many authors about the human experience is always just so powerful for me, because I'm amazed that they have this ability to sort of dig down into the human experience and reflect that back to us.
Well, I think that's why memoirs are so popular now, because what you're doing, and I've been writing a memoir for 20 years, is you're mining your family story. Because I grew up in 1950 in Wytheville, Virginia, which was the site of the worst polio epidemic in the United States.
I did not know that.
And because my brother had, at 9 years old, had died of polio 6 weeks before I was born.
Golly.
My life story was always bound up in the polio epidemic and being raised by a grief-struck family and being a baby that, because my mother was stricken, nobody expected me to survive. So,
yeah.
A friend of mine who's a writer, who's in a writing group with me, in about the year 2000, said to me, if you don't start writing about the polio epidemic, I'm going to pretend like it happened to me, and I'm going to start writing about it. And I thought, no, Kathleen, that's my story.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, you know, I remember as a child, because you and I are about the same age, the sort of anxiety in the summer, the parents, you know, by going to the swimming pool or whatever.
And that's not the way it was passed.
Yeah. And I have a good friend here, a fellow psychologist whose sister died of polio. He was also stricken and has had chronic muscle loss. And it really informs a life. So
it does.
And we won't get off on polio, but so think of authors which really speak to you in terms of the psychology or the sort of insight about the human experience, because it's such an important to me part of the whole reading experience.
Well, as I referenced, I like all the beat writers, and I am a woman who likes a lot of women writers. Mm-hmm. As a little girl, I wanted to be Jo in Little Women, and that was my sort of model. She wanted to be a writer, and I understood that, and I wanted to be a writer. I think Toni Morrison is probably one of the best writers out there now. Every time her book comes out, a new novel, I'm there.
Mm-hmm. I find her her writing to be challenging, and sometimes, I mean, she doesn't write about easy topics.
No. Beloved is about a mother who kills her own child.
Right.
I've taught that novel two or three times, and I remember when I read it, as soon as I got to the end of it, I went right back to the beginning of it. And I went around, I lived on Lexington Avenue then, I had all these windows, and I went around and lowered all the windows, so I couldn't see out, nobody could see in. I wanted to do nothing but read Beloved.
Golly. And as you think about coming of age, I mean, was there a book that really had a profound impact in your life as a young person, as a high schooler or college student?
Probably To Kill a Mockingbird,
mm-hmm.
As well as Little Women. And embarrassingly, and I know one other woman who's had this, Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first really long book that I was able to read. And I remember I was in the seventh grade, and I pretended that I was sick, which I did often, so that I could stay home and just read.
Mm-hmm. I think that book, despite its kind of romanticization of that period and perhaps even of slavery, really in some ways did speak to the Southern experience. You know, those
exactly.
of us who grew up in the South. I mean, I often think that it's a good overview of at least the sort of perspective of a white and privileged individual during that time.
Right.
Because it certainly reflects that. You know, I think for me, the book that I really remember, and I probably wouldn't have read it had it not been assigned in high school, was Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, interesting.
And for so many boys, young men then, I mean, I think it was something that said to me, gosh, what you're feeling and going through, someone else has felt and gone through. At a time in history, in both in terms of boys' relationships, never got talked about. So it was really an opening.
I wish I had found that book when I was in high school. What I remember about my high school was that there was a boys' reading list and a girls' reading list. And the girls' reading list, the top book was Pride and Prejudice. And I hated that book. And on the boys' reading list, the top book was Huckleberry Finn.
Interesting.
And I loved that book.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm a boy, I guess.
You know, it's funny. Two of my favorite books of all times, Cloud Splitter being one by Russell Banks.
I love that book.
The fictionalized version of John Brown. And it's been a while. I probably need to reread it, but that book just stuck with me.
Yeah.
And the other one was Shadow Country, the Watson series by Peter Matheson. You know, originally it was three books, and then he condensed it into one. I couldn't put that book down. I mean, it's challenging in spots. It's a tough read. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff in both of those books. But I think, again, that somehow allows us to see the bad stuff exists in the world, and there's a sort of a universality of that.
Yeah, I teach a Russell Banks novel called Rule of the Bone, and it's a very good, even though it touches on some very tough topics like child sexual abuse, it rang a bell with my boys at Hampton Sydney. I shouldn't call them boys, they're men. They go to college when you're 18 years old. And then when I tried to teach it in a high school here, and the English department wouldn't let you do it. Well, I did it anyway.
Yeah, let's come back to that, because that book, I found it very powerful as well. But we're just going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment with Mary Flo Stevens, my guest this morning on the Mind and Heart Show.
You're listening to The Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. The Mind and Heart Show is heard every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The number in the studio is 434-817-9470.
Mind and Heart this morning on 94.7 is being supported by Common Ground Healing Arts, a nonprofit wellness studio committed to engaging the whole community in healthy living. Practitioners provide evidence-based complementary health packages, including yoga, meditation, acupuncture, and massage, all on a sliding scale basis at the Jefferson School City Center in downtown Charlottesville. Common Ground Healing Arts also offers services on-site to people in locations such as Crescent Hall, the West Haven Nursing Clinic, and the Flavanna County Correctional Facility for Women. For more information or to book an appointment, please feel free to visit commongroundseville.org.
And we are back. And you're listening this morning to the Mind and Heart Show on 94.7 WPVC. And we are the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Our producer is Kevin Chapman. And we're here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 and dealing with all matters of the mind and heart. Just a quick check of the weather before we get back to discussion with our guest today, Mary Flo Stevens. It is currently 46 degrees in Charlottesville and sunny. We're looking today at a high of around 65. So here we go with this roller coaster weather again. Going to be sunny today, no precipitation. Tonight, low of 40, clear. So we're looking at a pretty nice weekend with the possibility of some rain tomorrow. So we're here this morning with Mary Flo Stevens, a writer, critic, teacher, all things literature. I have to also say she's heads up a book group to which I belong, and that's been a very terrific experience and a wonderful experience, and it's how I've come to know Mary Flo and really appreciate her, the breadth and depth of her knowledge in this area of literature. We're just talking about, before the break, about the Russell Banks book. Tell us the name of that book again.
Rule of the Bone.
Yeah, I spent much of my professional life dealing with that kind of situation, sex offenders and the like, and boy, that book, he just nails it, and the tragedy of it and the cost in human life, and on all, there's just no winners there. And I just love his willingness to take on such difficult... He's written some really tough stuff. In some ways, Cloud Splitter may be one of the less challenging of his books in terms of his more recent stuff. What do you know about him as a writer, and what can you tell us about him, Mary Flo?
I used to have a whole big file on Russell Banks. He has another book called The Sweet Hereafter that's quite good. And
Is that the one about the school bus with the kids that gets lost, I believe?
Yeah. I find it interesting to read one writer's au revoir. In other words, everything they've ever written. And I know he's unpopular, but I'm doing that right now with Truman Capote. His short stories are so good, every single one of them. And I probably have in my house 3 copies of the Holly Golightly novel, Breakfast at Tiffany's. And I saw that it was a new edition out, and I thought, well, I'll have to get that one. How many times can you read Truman Capote? I don't guess you can read him a lot.
Yeah, no, he's an interesting character. I mean, his life in some ways is as interesting a story as his writing, I think, sometime. The In Cold Blood, I mean, that was another book that...
That scared me to death.
Golly, that was a frightening book. But his ability to get inside the head of these guys and the complex... I mean, I'm not sure you could write that book now in terms of the access that he had.
Well, it's an important book because of the way that it came in the progression of the novel. It was the first nonfiction novel, and now there have been plenty of them. But that one was the first time you took a nonfiction story and you added a narrative, and that's why it was as big as it was,
okay.
Because it was the first one.
You know, that's interesting. I just learned something from you. I did not know that. I didn't know that that was the genre that he was...
Norman Mailer has tried it. I've read a number of the nonfiction novels now, and you know it's a whatever that is called the nonfiction novel.
Yeah.
But that's part of the narrative arc of where the novel has gone. And I think it's an important turn that it made. I have to say, I do have one pet peeve, and that is. People who believe that there is no such thing as true fiction, that your fiction must have elements of autobiography all through there. And I don't think that's true. It's not true with me. But the first short story I had published in the Virginia Quarterly Review, it was autobiographical. I even used the same names. I wrote about a newspaper reporter covering a murder trial, which I did.
Right.
Same murder trial, quoted my own story. I mean, ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I don't know where fiction springs from, actually. I shouldn't have even gone down this road. But it's not always autobiographical. Mm-hmm.
I would tend to agree only because I think that, you know, some of it comes out of the imagination. Some of it comes out of observing other things or learning of other
exactly.
things in our world.
Exactly. I had a very good friend who was a country music songwriter, and she had published country music songs, and she'd worked for Emmylou Harris, and I just followed her around one day and interviewed her and made all kinds of notes. And then when it was ready, out sprung it came, a story I wrote, which is now the basis of a novel I'm working on called Full Price Angel.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine was the fiction editor of Streetlights, and she said, it's an online journal based here in Charlottesville. And she said, don't you have any unpublished short stories? And I said, Susie, no. Six or seven, or they've all been published, and usually in the VQR.
Mm-hmm.
Because Stage Blackford, when he got to know your work at the Virginia Quarterly, he was very good. But then I found Full Price Angel. I hadn't wanted to submit it because it married journalism and fiction writing.
Interesting.
I had a character be me, only with a best-selling song, going platinum.
That's great. Now, would historical fiction belong to that same genre, or is that a whole different ballgame? Excuse me.
Historical fiction marries journalism with fiction. My college roommate always reminds me, I have a saying that says, never say never, so I should never say that I'll never write historical fiction, but it's not my genre.
Mm-hmm.
I have worked on historical fiction pieces based on the wife of Woodrow Wilson because she came from my hometown.
Okay.
Edith Bowling Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
I did a whole lot of research. I wrote a couple pages, and then I was done.
Mm-hmm. the book I mentioned earlier, Cloud Splitter, I mean, clearly that's what Russell Banks has done. He's taken that whole John Brown story and...
And he gave it his own turn.
He did. And brilliantly, I think, in terms of the development of that character and the at least his attempt to get inside the head of that character. And you know, who knows what went on with this man, but, I mean, I think he did a really remarkable job of creating that. And mm-hmm. it just carries the book so beautifully. There's a historical book I read a year or two ago, and I'm blocking on the name of it, but it was a new look at the whole thing at Harper's Ferry. But it didn't attempt to sort of look at Brown's motives beyond sort of
was
the obvious thing.
Was it a nonfiction book?
It was a nonfiction book.
And I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, but I almost cannot read nonfiction. When I was a middle schooler, I read women's biographies all the time. But I'm not a nonfiction reader. I'm embarrassed by it. And my husband can read history book after history book, and I'll pick up a book of history, and it's like it's instant narcolepsy. I go right to sleep. It's a shame because I could educate myself better if I could.
Yeah.
But I can't. I think, though, when I was coming of age, there were no models around for how I wanted to live. And that's why I spent all my time in the library reading about women's lives, because I didn't see mm-hmm. a life that was like the life I wanted.
Yeah. Actually, you anticipated one of my questions, which had to do with your preference for fiction versus nonfiction. I think you just answered it.
Yeah. I got to have a narrative. I got to have a story.
Yeah. Even stuff that really grabs me, I share that. I mean, I think, oh, I should read that. I'm going to read that. And then couple chapters in, it's just not carrying me. You know, I love to have a book in progress that I can't wait to get back to.
Exactly.
I'm going to go to bed early so I can read an extra hour.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I loved about being away. I can read all day.
Yeah, it enriches your life. There was a best-selling book, I didn't read it, several years ago called Emotional Intelligence.
Yes, and Daniel Goleman, I believe.
It had a lot to do with that newspaper article I referenced about how reading a novel can make you smarter.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time I would have conversations with especially doctors and lawyers and engineers, and I would think, you need to read the book Emotional Intelligence.
Yes.
Because guess what? You don't have any.
Right, right. And it really does go to that notion of seeing the world in a different perspective, sort of broadening our perspective.
Right.
I love that about fiction. Insights into the human experience that I'd perhaps never run across. I mean, you must see all of that in your reading.
And I think that's true with just storytelling in general. Although my father was a pharmacist, he was a very good storyteller. And people would come into his drugstore and go straight back to the counter, not just to get their drugs, but to hear him tell stories.
Interesting. And that's a real tradition in the South, isn't it?
It's a tradition in the South. And I also found this note that I made to myself that's in one of my essays. If your mother chooses you to tell her stories to, you will become a writer.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And I think that was very much a tradition in Native American families.
Okay.
There was always in every tribe a storyteller, somebody to keep the stories alive. And I also think that if your teacher chooses you to somehow bring out a story, you will become a writer. I had a seventh grade teacher who wanted us all to submit an essay contest. And instead of writing a regular essay, I should have known better. I wrote a spoof, a satire, because I am a humor writer, and it was her. And I thought I was going to be expelled from the school. But she turned it in to the newspaper. It won first prize. I got $7.
Oh, boy.
And she said, you don't know how to spell, or you can't use good grammar. How have you gone to school for 8 years and not learned any spelling or any grammar? And I said, I don't know. But the whole essay
that's
was
funny.
Covered in red.
Yeah. You know, I think
I still can't spell.
Well, that's why we have spell check. You know, I think of writers like Truman Capote, Eudora Welty, Harper Lee. I could go on. What is it you think about the Southern experience that informs, or I don't know.
I think it's the place of metaphor. Eudora Welty is one of my favorite authors, and I've got books of hers that I've read over and over and over, and I've had an agent who was with Rosalind Volkanin, who represented Eudora Welty. Mm. I was fortunate enough to meet Robert Giroux, who brought out the work of Flannery O'Connor, and also knew Eudora Welty. Eudora Welty said things like, she had a character say, instead of saying she was badly dressed, she said, the way this character dresses, she goes into her closet and says, I'm going to Greenwood. Whatever clothes want to go to Greenwood, Mississippi with me, fall on my back. And that's how she dressed.
Yeah. And it's also been interesting to me, the distinction between the white Southern writer and the black African-American Southern writer. I mean, I think you get such a different, again, perspective, because I think a Southern experience is way different for those two groups. You know, you think of a Southern black writer and the different power to that.
Yeah, I think probably The Color Purple, Alice Walker's book, had the biggest impact on me that any book has ever had.
Really?
And I was a grown-up.
Golly.
But it's all about voice.
Yes.
It's all about educating that voice. And it has spiritual themes. Forgiveness. She's raped by her stepfather.
Oh, yeah.
And the voice changes. And learning to read is what saves her. But I remember reading that. I remember driving down Park Street thinking, Alice Walker really has something to say. Do I have anything to say? And then I thought, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I have something to say.
Yeah.
So it gave me permission somehow.
To say it. Yeah.
To say it.
Do you have a favorite Southern writer, fiction writer?
Probably Eudora Welty and Alice Walker.
Okay.
And Toni Morrison is up there.
You can keep adding the names.
I can keep adding.
Yeah.
I think it's The Optimist's Daughter that I've read over and over again, but I've also read all of the Eudora Welty's stories. I've read her criticisms. She's got a book of criticisms called The Eye of the Story. I don't think I'm a particularly good critic. Thank you for calling me one, but I never thought I was particularly good at it. She's good at it.
I wanted to just pick your brain for a moment. We were talking about Harper Lee and the controversy about this sequel to Kill a Mockingbird, and some pushback about sort of the change that in Atticus with regards to his racial views. I mean, what's your take on that?
It's too bad that second book came out.
It's true.
And I know from insider sources that she was suffering a little bit from dementia.
I wondered about that.
And was not completely in control of that intellectual property.
Okay.
And it would be interesting to read the book by Charles Shields, Mockingbird. Now that I've said I can't read nonfiction, I did read Mockingbird, which he really goes in to Harper Lee and it's as close to a biography of Harper Lee you'll ever get,
okay.
And that gives you a lot of insight.
Okay. And I had wondered that as well, that maybe she was
Jean fading. Louise should have stayed a child.
I agree.
Jean Louise as an adult made a lousy adult.
Really? And sort of, to me, tarnished the whole Scout character.
It did.
I just, you know, adored that character and thought Atticus.
And when Truman Capote wrote about Harper Lee, he would say she wanted to be a boy.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so by making Jean Louise
a tomboy,
a grown-up in that Ghost Set of Watchmen with a boyfriend, where was the sex in that book?
Yeah.
There was no sex in that book.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a disappointment from my perspective, and I think I wondered about any financial motives of those who were driving the publication of that.
Yeah, the people who had control of her estate had control of that, and it's a shame. But the publication process damages a lot of people. I mean, people say, why didn't she write another book? Why didn't she write another book? You think about writing, and I just said to my old sweet mates from JMU yesterday at lunch, writing is something you do by yourself.
Yeah.
And then once the publication's out, you're out in front of everybody, and it's a completely different thing, and it's ruined a lot of people.
Do you think because it sort of goes to their head, or do you think because it's this cult of celebrity gets built up around it?
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
I guess that's true. And I gathered all these articles together that I'd written, and then I realized in this day and age, you can just Google my name and come to this. But I had written a satire for the Washington Post called I Was a Support Group Junkie. And at the time, the Oprah Winfrey Show was assembling a show on support group junkies. And they found my satire, called me up and brought me on the show. And I thought, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. There's no way I can be in front of 25 million people. I'll look fat. You know how women think.
Right.
But it was fine. It was just like talking. It was just like I'm talking to you right now. Mm-hmm. I might as well have been sitting in my own living room. But it was very clear to me that the other support group junkies on the show, they really had to go to a support group every day, sometimes twice a day. And it wouldn't have been right to make fun of them.
Right.
But the producer said, we need humor. We need you to come on.
Yeah.
I gave him every excuse. I said, I'm afraid to fly, which I am. I have to fly with my husband. We'll fly him up, too.
Yeah. The other thing about literature, I think, is it gives us insights into the lives of others. The book we recently read in book group, Roundhouse, really opened my eyes about the experience of Native Americans and the life on the reservation. And I think she just does a fabulous job in that book, and I understand in others, I've not read them, of really bringing the Native American experience to those of us who don't know anything about it.
And if it weren't in a story form, you wouldn't have gotten that. You can read...
Right.
That plot hinged on matters of territory. If a crime is committed on an Indian reservation or if a crime is committed on public land. And you can write a legal definition of that in, what, 5 pages?
Right.
But setting it in a story in a family with a mother who's the rape victim and a teenage son who wants to avenge that crime.
Yes.
That's what really moved me. It was a very powerful book. It was a very discussable book. People recommend books to me for that book group all the time. And I've been doing that since the 1980s.
Wow.
So many, many years. And you have to find a discussable book.
Yes. Yeah.
Every good book isn't a discussable book.
No. Yeah. One other thought about that book was the emphasis on storytelling
exactly.
In that culture and the kind of insular nature of that culture in terms of, you know, those folks feeling really cut off from mainstream America, I think.
Well, they were cut off. We chased them out.
Yeah, we ran them out, right? So you're listening to The Mind and Heart Show. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. We have with us in the studio this morning Mary Flo Stevens, writer, critic, teacher, professor. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with some final questions.
You're listening to The Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. The Mind and Heart Show is heard every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The number in the studio is 434-817-9470.
And we are back with The Mind and Heart Show. Real quick check of the weather again. We're still at 46 degrees, and it's going to get to be a high of 65 today and sunny. So good chance to get outdoors, and maybe this portends an early spring. So we're here this morning with Mary Flo Stevens, and we're talking about the psychology of literature and the role of literature in our lives and how it illuminates the human experience. And just, I think, the importance of being a reader to being a fully rounded human being. I just don't think non-readers have blinders on. I don't think they have a chance to really see the world through the eyes of others. And that was the reason I wanted Mary Flo to join us today to share some insights on that. So would you agree with that, Mary Flo, about the sort of how limited one's life could be without literature?
I do. And I saw a quote about writing that I tried to put on some personally designed stationery, and it's from one writer to another, Nazim Hikmet, And the quotation is, "If I don't burn, if you don't burn, how will the darkness ever turn into light?"
Yeah, that's great. So, I love that.
The writer was asked, "Why do you keep writing?" And he said, "If I don't burn, if you don't burn."
Yeah,
it's very important. And it's important for young people. I remember one of my favorite novels is Toni Morrison's novel, Sula. And I've read it multiple times, and I've listened to it on tape. And I was driving my 10-year-old daughter in the car with me, and she was falling asleep but waking back up, and she was listening to Sula. And I knew she got it when she said, "Bring me a Dewey, bring me a Dewey." Because in Sula, she calls all her children Deweys.
Okay.
And she just plugged into that, and she got that.
Do you think there are folks, writers, particularly fiction writers, that sort of have this burning compulsion or burning need to write? I mean, I often feel that with books.
I don't think you'd do it if you didn't have a burning need to do it.
I mean, it's a huge undertaking.
For one thing, you don't know if anything's going to be successful.
Yeah.
For another thing, I'm a social person. I like to be with other people and talk my head off. I don't want to be holed up in my house.
Yeah,
writing something that may never see the light of day.
And you hear about books like, I'm thinking of more recent books, like The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt or All the Light We Cannot See. 10 years I read both of those novels. Took 10 years to write. I
loved both of those books.
I did too, yeah. It seemed to me like they were worthy of the 10 years.
They're worthy of it. They are.
You know, that they were just beautifully written. I mean, I know some folks, including my wife, thought that The Goldfinch could have used a little more
that
editing.
Could have been cut.
Thought it was a little long. I didn't feel that way. I thought it just provided wonderful insights, none the least of which was about the teenage boy experience now, as opposed to, say, Salinger or someone else, that she really got it. She really got it.
She really got it.
Yeah. And 10 years, I can't even imagine coming back to something. Do you write it? I mean, do they sit down and write every day for 2 hours? Do they write for a week and then take a... I mean, it's always been fascinating to me.
Just recently, and I've been writing fiction for, 25 years at least, I make myself work every day. And this is something, when I completed the novel that I've referenced, which is called The Boy Who Moved a Mountain, if 4 o'clock came around and it was the end of the day and I hadn't written, I would sit down and write.
Golly.
And I'm doing that again now.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's because writers, if one can generalize, just feel like they have something to say or they need to say it? I mean, I'm so fascinated by that process, being not a writer.
Well, plot-driven stories are different than language-driven stories.
Okay.
And I think that most people would agree that literary books are language-driven stories.
Meaning the quality of the writing?
What is driven is not a whodunit.
Okay.
The John Grisham, the thrillers, the David Dalrymple, they're plot-driven.
Yes, definitely.
That character could be any cardboard character in the universe.
Right.
Doesn't matter. Character's not going to change. It's not going to turn on language. I recently made myself finish a short story I started 6 years ago called Wall of Flame, which actually stems from something that happened when I was, my last journalism job, I was in a bar and caught on fire and nobody left. Everybody just said, "Oh, well." And I thought, well, what if I was playing a piano bar in a bar that caught on fire and then... I don't know about that particular bar, but it used to be regulars would have their pictures up on a bar. And I thought, well, if it catches on fire, those pictures would curl up, and it would be, instead of Wall of Fame, it would be a Wall of Flame.
Interesting.
So I had my character, who is a piano bar player, gesturing to the wall and saying, "See this wall of flame, wall of fame? It's really a wall of flame." And I got this quote from my husband because I had misquoted it. And somebody in the bar says, well, if music be the fool of life, play on. And she said, no, that's not right. If music is the food of love, play on. The fools of life are right here in this bar.
That's great.
So I didn't know she was going to say that until she said that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a language thing. The play on the word fools, the play on the word food, the wall of fame, wall of flame.
Yeah, no, I love that.
I'm not saying it's a great short story, but it's finished. Yeah. I don't have to look at it and say, I never finished this.
Yeah.
Why didn't I finish this?
And then there are also, I don't know if it comes under one of those headings, character-driven novels as well. I mean, really, I love those because I love the author getting inside someone's head and telling us who they are.
And if you look at a character-driven novel, the character changes. It might not always be a coming-of-age story. It was so disappointing to read Go Set a Watchman that I went back and reread To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm. And from about page 5 or 10, Jim is trying so hard to be his own person.
Yeah.
And trying so hard not to follow in his father's footsteps. And is finding things about Atticus he never knew, mm-hmm. such as the fact that he was a very good shot with a gun.
Yes, with the rifle.
And Jean Louise just wants to be a boy.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that, again, we're generalizing here, but that writers sometimes have a level of suffering, if that's not too strong a word, or something internal that also might drive the need to put it on paper?
Oh, yeah, because I think it can be, writing can be a very healing thing. Mm-hmm. I was visited recently by an old friend who became a pulmonary surgeon, and he said, I found the story you had written about your sister dying of lung cancer in the Washington Post. And I didn't know how he found that story, but that was a story I had to write. It was when the governor of Virginia, George Allen, was giving out free cigarettes because they're made in Virginia.
Yeah.
And the headline writer for that story, fortunately, wasn't me. And the headline writer said, with a sister's death from lung cancer, support for tobacco makes no sense. But that was very healing for me to write it. Didn't bring her back.
Right.
Mm. And that wasn't fiction, but
it was life.
It was life.
We've touched a little bit on the importance of the emotional development of young people to be readers, and I worry, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about this, about absent that, what's the cost, what's the loss for people coming of age?
Well, they have no reference points. You need a reference point when you're coming of age. Just the way that you referred to Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye.
Right.
And at this writing conference I was in New York City, the agents and editors always talked about comps. And what they meant was, this new book is Catcher in the Rye meets To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah. It's that type of a comp thing. It's a reference point thing. Most people, when they talk about books that were important to them, can remember where they were when they read it.
Mm-hmm.
How old they were, where they were sitting. I can remember a chair in my house, and I loved the book Pippi Longstocking mm-hmm. when I was little and growing up. And I remember the chair I was sitting in when I read it. And I often wish that I would get stricken with some dire disease so I could just stay in bed and read.
Right. Were there for you books that really made you think, gee, I want to write? I mean, that you read them and you thought, this is so rich and this is so amazing. I want to do that.
Actually, I have to go back to Kill a Mockingbird.
Okay.
I felt like I knew Boo Radley.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I wanted to replicate something of that. As before the we started talking, I referenced the fact that I was a music major my first year in college, and I remembered one thing that I would have loved to have done, but I don't have the talent for it, and that is to read a book, see it made into a movie, and write the musical score.
Golly.
But I've written a couple of songs, mm-hmm. but I know I don't have the kind of musical talent that it takes to evoke mood in music. But I think I can evoke it, or at least come close to evoking it, in words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dumb luck.
You know, in thinking about the show today, the other thing that came to mind was how there's been appears to me an upsurge in fiction coming out of the Middle East and all that's been going on there. I think of the books out of Iraq, Iran, and how important that has those books have been to.
Yeah, reading Lolita in Tehran,
yes.
Very good.
And helping us see what the experience there again on the ground
and
we need to understand
Syria, and I don't think we can read a book of geography about it and understand it quite so well. I was at this writing conference with a woman who wrote a folk tale about refugees, and unfortunately she didn't use the word Syria, but she told us afterwards in the roundtable discussion, well, this is really set in Syria, and the editor said, use the word Syria.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to understand that.
Kite Runner, is that the book I'm thinking of?
Kite Runner, definitely. And then the book after that was A Thousand Splendid Suns, and the book after that was And the Mountains Echoed.
Yeah.
And you understand Afghanistan if you read those three novels.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So would you have a handful, top two or three, four books that you feel like we should encourage young people to read, just again as sort of an introduction to the richness of this experience of reading fiction?
I was always successful, especially at Hampton Sydney, in getting boys to read, young men to read, by starting with On the Road. It's a very landmark book. It's a lot about independence. It's a lot about different cultures. Also, Julian Bond once told me, and I agree with him, that the best book about race that's ever been written is William Faulkner's The Reavers.
Really?
I can read it over and over and over.
Golly, yeah.
And The Reavers is really, really good. And at the moment when an older African-American man is going to have a young white boy stay in his house, somebody says, he's a white boy, he can't stay in your house. And the older man says, there's some place at which color comes off and just people starts.
Mm.
And that book is written mostly in dialect, which people want to clean that up now, and I understand that. But it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Read The Reavers if you haven't read it.
I haven't read it, actually, I'm embarrassed to say, but I will definitely put it on my list. We're just about out of time this morning. This has been a wonderful discussion. I'm so pleased to share it with our listeners. I want to remind everyone that if you joined us late, you can hear the entire discussion with Mary Flo Stevens on our podcast, which should be available Monday at the latest on SeavillePodcast.com. And just go on there and search for Mind and Heart Show, and we'll pop all of our shows, including our show today. I wonder if you have any closing thoughts for us, Mary Flo, about literature and psychology and the human experience. I know that's pretty broad, but just based upon what we've talked about today.
Just read, read, read. Read all you can.
Yeah, no, I would agree.
And go back and reread your favorite books.
Yeah, yeah. The
memoir I was referencing, Borrowed Finery, it's the first time I've ever padded a book. And that writer, it's Paula, I think Little Jones is her, I can't remember her last name, but Paula. Her short story was nominated when mine was for the Balch Prize at the Virginia Quarterly Review, and she won. And I went to her story, and I thought, if her story's better than mine, I don't mind. And I read her story, and it was better than mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're really lucky, just a closing thought, to live in a community where a lot of readers, a lot of writers. I mean, I've lived in communities, I know you have, in other parts of the state or the country, where it's not what I would call a literary community. I feel so fortunate that we have, because there's a gazillion book groups in this town. You run into authors on the downtown mall. You know, the old
and read John Casey's Spartina. That's a very good book.
Yeah.
It won the National Book Award for a reason.
Yes, it was a very good
book. And he was my teacher.
Yeah, interesting. At the MFA program.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. Well, if we're going to wrap up today, you've been listening to The Mind and Heart Show. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Our show today was produced by Kevin Chapman, and our guest has been Mary Lou Stevens. We've had a wide-ranging discussion about psychology and literature. I want to thank you very much for coming in today.
You're very welcome.
And,
thanks for having me.
See you soon. So we're going to sign off. Stay tuned for Straight Talk with Andra Hakes coming up at the top of the hour, and we will see you next week.
You've been listening to The Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Be sure and tune in again next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock for another edition of The Mind and Heart Show, only on WPVC-LP, Charlottesville.